Good evening, folks, and welcome back on this Saturday, the 30th day of April, 2022. I'm your host, Mark Gall, and it's been quite a week. No question, the decline and fall of the once great American Republic is accelerating at this point on just about every front you can imagine. What's interesting is more and more it's becoming obvious, and even the left, or at least some of them, are beginning to get almost embarrassed at the depths to which their, well, comrades have now sunk. I'll start with this story to make the point. From Kenosha, Wisconsin, where the city council and the five-person parks commission have delayed a decision that would have placed a memorial and a plaque in a city park to the criminal, Anthony Huber, past and then current felon, caught on video attempting to kill Kyle Rittenhouse with a skateboard. And, of course, acting in self-defense, Kyle Rittenhouse made that the last thing this particular scumbag ever did. That didn't stop the city of Kenosha from saying, hey, we really love that kind of criminality. Let's celebrate it with a memorial, for crying out loud. The UK's Daily Mail covered it and said, Kenosha City Council fell into chaos this week during discussions over a proposed taxpayer-funded memorial for one of the men that Kyle Rittenhouse killed in self-defense. And some people are now, your host would say rightfully at minimum, questioning why the evil commission voted to table the idiocy rather than simply vote it down.
Are you crazy? Or just plain stupid?
Stupid is stupid does, Mrs. Blue.
I guess
so, too. Kevin Mathewson, former Kenosha alderman, who now works as an investigative journalist, attended the meeting, recorded the proceedings, and then posted them to YouTube, and says that he's convinced that had the existence of this abomination not been revealed, in other words, if they'd been able to do it under the radar, he's certain it would have passed, which is why they tabled it and then met behind closed doors to discuss it in violations of the state's open meetings laws. But hey, who cares about the law, right? If you break it badly enough, you get a memorial in Wisconsin. I'm really starting to wonder if the city of Milwaukee might decide to put up a statue to Jeffrey Dahmer next. And come to think of it, folks, it's not like the media hasn't already granted sainthood to George Floyd for committing suicide by fentanyl. And most importantly, inspiring looting, arson, and mayhem nationwide. He's not only got a lot of memorials, but kind of like Stalin, they're rewriting history for him, too. Let's counterpoint that next with what ought to be a bit of good news. That is, if it wasn't necessary to have people speaking out like this in the first place. Out of Congress, of all places, where Representative Jim Jordan of Ohio called out the scumbag masquerading as Achtung Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas for being, yeah, he used the word, a traitor, as well as out of touch. The ranking member of the House Judiciary Committee said during his open statement that Mayorkas will rightfully face questions about why he was, well, we know that, but why he implemented policies that led to the border invasion. Quote, it's intentional. He said it has to be. The chaos on our southern border is not an accident. It's deliberate. It's on purpose. It's by design. And then he went on to recount the ways why that's so obviously true. The fact that the Biden Fuhrer on day one said he would institute a moratorium on deportation. So, hey, come on in, invaders. The door is open and the wall is down. He ended the Trump administration's Remain in Mexico policy. He terminated agreements with the Northern Triangle countries. And then he stopped building the wall. They're giving him lots of free goodies, folks. From bus passes and plane trips to free phones, not to mention exemptions from the poison pokes that are killing Americans. But those policies, continued Jim Jordan, done intentionally, and there's no doubt on that score, have led to all kinds of bad outcomes, including, of course, over 3 million invaders. And not only that, as Jordan pointed out, that scumbag there testifying before them claimed that the border is secure. Colorado Representative Ken Buck told Mayorkas during that same committee hearing on Wednesday, my constituents want you impeached, and you're darn right they do, because he said they believe, and they're correct, folks, that you've committed treason. They believe you're a traitor. They compare you to Benedict Arnold. Whereupon he asked the scumbag, are you ashamed for what you've done to this country? You already know the answer. Oh, he was offended that the representative would even dare to ask him the question. The most disgusting thing, arguably, folks, was that he dared to sit there before the TV cameras behind a sign that said, The Honorable Alejandro Mayorkas. No, let's be clear here. A cheap hooker who gives her clients diseases is honorable by comparison. But let's close this one off by giving Jim Jordan his due. The Daily Mail's coverage says 2 months after the highest level of illegal border crossings in 2021, Mayorkas insisted that the border was secure and that the regime, I'm not going to use the term they did, was carrying out its plan at the southern crossings. I don't think there's much doubt there. Quote, Mr. Secretary, if over 200,000 a month and all of the ramifications that has with drugs coming into the country and other people coming into the country because our agents are so focused on that, if that's a secure border, then you are completely out of touch with the American people, charged Jordan. We have a Secretary of Homeland Security who is intentionally, deliberately, in a premeditated fashion, executing a plan. His words, executing a plan to overwhelm our country with millions and millions of illegal immigrants, he added. Executing a plan that causes all kinds of harm to people who make the journey. Executing a plan that results in record levels of fentanyl and other drugs entering our nation. Executing a plan that stresses our border agents, stresses our education and healthcare system, stresses our nation. All, he said, done intentionally. Whereupon he played a 3.5-minute video montage demonstrating the evil of the Biden regime's plan to destroy the nation's borders and reduce it to the state of a third world cesspool. Seriously, folks, the question is, why aren't there indictments being issued and criminal trials being scheduled? And why hasn't this guy already been impeached? Here's one more related story, published by the Gateway Pundit as the week rolled to a close by Joe Hoft, and most of it in turn credits the Military Times, reporting on the purge of anyone with a religious or scriptural orientation from the Obama-Biden military. Three active duty service members, it begins, appeared in a segment aired Thursday on a podcast hosted by Representative Matt Gaetz, R. Florida, accusing, and obviously this one's correct too, the Department of Defense, how's that for a misnomer, of using the COVID-1984 plandemic vaccine mandate to intentionally purge religious service members. Air Force Captain Jordan Carr, Army Major Samuel Sigaloff, and Air Force Master Sergeant Nicholas Krupper all made their cases from a variety of angles, including religious freedom, controversy over the so-called emergency authorization versus the official Federal Death Authority approved version of the Pfizer not vaccine. They didn't just cut corners, folks, and avoid actual testing. They cut everything even remotely looking like law as well. Oh, and yeah, let's not forget what was once called natural immunity to the novel coronavirus. But all of them agreed that involuntary separation policy for vaccine refusal is part of a concerted effort to remove certain members of the military. All three are members or party to at least one of several lawsuits that various troops have filed against the Department of Defense. Good grief. It disgusts me even to say that, folks, given what this department has turned into. Alleging for the most part that the religious exemption process, for which virtually no one is ever allowed to actually be exempt, is unconstitutional. Said Carr, if you're a believer and you're listening to this podcast, you need to understand that God-fearing service members are being intentionally purged from the services. Added Sigaloff, it's a purposeful purge. Anyone who would disobey an unlawful order is being purged out of the military, and there's a shadow policy in place that is protecting all of the people enforcing this shadow policy. It's about trying to destroy the United States, folks, by invasion from without and destroying its military from within. And so far, you have to admit, it may be satanic as all hell, but it's been extremely, I'll say it, damned successful. Sad as it may be to admit, I think we'd better come out and say it. A nation that allows this to happen right before their eyes doesn't deserve to continue to exist. It's certainly no longer free. And one more time, let's be honest, what the hell are these people fighting for anyway? From there, let's back up a bit and start a chronological review of the week from early on, and then circle back on around to where we started here. And given the rumors that led into the weekend, I guess you could say the week started out with some good news. There wasn't a nuclear war yet. The warnings from the Russian Ministry of Defense that had to do with NATO retaliation against Russia for something that was expected to happen over the weekend, reported via Pravda, didn't end up happening as, planned on Sunday. And that means that while there may be some very disappointed globalists who didn't get their nuclear megadeaths yet, but who also probably haven't given up yet on their goal of pushing the world towards nuclear destruction, those warnings were, at worst, premature. And if in the process they raise some eyebrows or even lulled a few people out of complacency, that's probably a net positive. Who knows? Maybe they even convinced a few more people that having a diaper wearer at the helm in such a time as this is a really stupid idea. From there, though, let's move on to talk about things that, without a doubt, are happening, like famine by design. Out of the UK, as if record food prices weren't high enough, says Tyler Durden, the Russia-Ukraine conflict, or so we're being told, has now choked off the world sunflower oil supply, forcing, at least for now, the largest supermarket chain in the United Kingdom to begin rationing. The Guardian is reporting that Tesco, with more than 4,000 retail stores there, has placed limits of 3 cooking oil bottles per customer on purchases. And that follows Waitrose and Morrisons, other supermarket chains that have already set limits of just 2 per customer. And continues the piece, as retailers panic about sourcing edible oils, retail cooking oil prices have already been driven up an average of 20% over just last year. Here's something that shouldn't surprise anybody from deeper down in the same story. Supermarkets are also placing buying restrictions on olive oil and rapeseed oils, and ultimately any other oils that might be useful as replacements. And there was news on Friday that Indonesia, the world's largest palm oil producer, has announced an export ban on all cooking oil and palm oil products there, adding even more tightness, who could have thought it, to global cooking oil supplies. What do you guess, folks? There may be other factors involved, too, from energy shortages to the usual out-of-control money printing, all of which are going to result in the same food price hyperinflation and ultimately shortages. And yes, if they are able to do what they intend to, it'll be widespread famine. And what's interesting is they're openly talking about that, now that it's pretty well a fait accompli. For example, last week, one of the big, well-connected deep state public-private partners, the president of the Rockefeller Foundation, Rajiv Shah, was nice enough to give a report to Bloomberg Television's David Westin about a timeline on when he thought the crisis could erupt, like sometime in the next 6 months, which your host can't help but think probably means they believe it's already too late to stop it. Try not to break your arm, guys, congratulating yourselves on a job well done. Concludes Zero Hedge's summary, and not for the first time. Remember, they say the Rockefeller Foundation has views that are closely aligned with the World Economic Forum. Your host can't help but note, yep, one of the world's most evil public-private partners, or puppet masters, all of which are advocating for a global reset. The reset they really want is the global food supply chain, and it's only out of a crisis, like the one that all of these people have been working so hard to foment, that they can implement their desired change, such as no more red meat for the peons, the masses, but how about some grubs and insects instead? Oh yeah, let's not forget, Bill Gates wants to sell you some vat-grown pretendo meat. You won't know exactly what's in it, but you know what's not. No wonder they want to kill so many chickens and turkeys while they're at it, too. Before I move on, a couple of related observations from David Icke, who points to the very same story about Shah reimagining a global famine, which will begin sometime in the next 6 months. Shah's appearance on Bloomberg, says the author here, is interesting because of the Foundation's repetitive talk about the need for the global, for the global food supply to be reset to a more sustainable one. Read, you guys don't get any food. The Foundation has closely aligned views, he too observes, with the WEF, advocating for that global reset, and as founder Klaus Schwab famously said back in early 2020, just months after the plandemic began, the plandemic represents a rare but narrow window of opportunity to reflect, reimagine, and reset our world to create a healthier, more equitable, and more prosperous future. And while he and other global elitists have been calling for a global reset, says Icke, the Rockefeller Foundation's managing editor of Food Initiatives, one Sarah Farley, has also been parroting the same message. In a note published on the WEF website entitled, How to Reimagine Our Food Systems for a Post-COVID World, good grief, she outlined the need to redesign supply chains with nutrition and human health in mind. What she doesn't say is that they want to improve it. What they really want to do, folks, is undermine and destroy it. And if that's not obvious, you haven't been paying attention, said Roy Steiner, the senior VP of the Food Initiative for the Rockefeller Foundation. Quote, the world is spending far too much on foods that are bad for people and bad for the planet. You know, like real beef and real chicken and other things that they simply don't want you to have. And note that they don't plan on missing any meals any more than they worry about Jet A fuel for their fleet of Gulfstreams. They are among other globalists that have been advocating to have protein and the peons' diets replaced with insects. One obvious place where Big Brother globalists are making big progress is in the openly socialist European Union, where Italy has now announced a rollout of the dystopian socialist credit system there to, quote, conserve resources. Yep, it's the first of its kind in the EU, and compliant good little slaves, aka citizens, will be rewarded by Big Brother for their good behavior, writes Julian Conradson for the Gateway Pundit. Socialist, and I put that ist on there, of course, because people rarely get it right. Socialist credit scores are already in use in various places around the globe, but nowhere more so than in the communist hellhole, that is, communist China. The dystopian measurement acts in a similar fashion to what he calls the traditional credit score. However, as the new name indicates, one score has little to do with financial prospects or ability to pay off debts on time. No, socialist credit scores are all about your level of compliance to the regime and your acceptance of the approved narrative. And nowadays, I guess you could say, if you're a Californian at least, virtue signaling as well. For example, if a socialist credit score was in full effect in the United States already, and you wanted to donate money to an organization like the NRA, or a not PC politician, or even Torah teacher, or buy stocks in oil companies, well, pretty much anything that the leftists deem far right, or environmentally not acceptable, or politically not acceptable, or just about anything they don't like, your score would take a big hit. Too many hits, and yep, you guessed it, your purchasing power not only goes down the drain, pretty soon you might not even be allowed to buy or sell. So with this dystopian coercion tool being used already in authoritarian dictatorships like China, where there's no such thing as individual rights, much less free speech, it might be assumed that this system wouldn't be compatible with the United States, he says. Yeah, folks, I guess some people still aren't paying attention. Or even in the West, but sadly that's not the case, hasn't been for a long time, because governments across what was once called the free Western world are now adopting this communist tyranny, especially in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic, which proved that governments could exercise virtually limitless power if they duped people effectively enough first. All of this sets the stage for the next phase of the WEF's Project 2030, in which, as you recall, you're supposed to own nothing and be happy, or maybe just be dead. Anyway, as of right now, says Conradson, there's no official government-sponsored socialist credit system in the West, but that's changing. First, thanks to Italy, which has announced the rollout of their new rewards-based program that is intended to modify people's climate change behavior by assigning a score based on compliance. The first of its kind in the EU. And it's going to kick off as a pilot program starting the fall of this year in the large metropolitan city of Bologna, where citizens who comply with the radical climate change agenda and display good behavior, like correctly recycling and using public transportation, will be rewarded with official cryptocurrencies and discounts to local retailers, according to their local newspaper, Bologna Today. Enrollees will be given, and listen carefully to this, their smart citizen wallet, where their rewards can be accessed. And the higher one's score, consistent with good behavior, you'll get more bennies. At first, participation will be optional. Guess how long that'll last. And guess how long it'll be a wallet that you hold in your hand as opposed to being put in your hand. Maybe your forehead, too. Anyway, this is not unlike, the author notes, the dystopian vaccine passport, which he says has already become a staple of everyday life, if you're allowed to anyway, in the EU. Now, at this point, folks, your host, at least briefly, has to put on my nerdy engineer hat and note that when they roll out something like this, it's almost guaranteed to be a success. Because guess who the people who are willing to get this vaccine passport and or this new cryptocurrency wallet for their wonderful good behavior are going to be? The very people who are willing to sign up for something like this are the very people who are willing to behave properly in exchange for all the bennies they're going to get from their beloved Big Brother. In other words, these are the very same types of people who are willing to take the poison poke without knowing what it was going to do and without even the incentive of getting a free drink at their local bar or a free Big Mac. In other words, folks, of course it's a success because the idiots will self-select and you won't know what's really going to happen until they try to coerce those who know better. Nothing we haven't seen before, and certainly aren't just about ready to see again. Here's another one from TGP, this time from Alexander Connell. It takes us back to the border, and he writes about states that have now joined the lawsuit over the Biden regime's, Well, anti-constitutional mishandling. In other words, encouraging an invasion at the southern border. It's Republican attorneys general, it says, that are only asking the Biden-Fuhrer to follow the law, good luck there, and allow for a period of public comment. What? Do they really care what the public says anyway? Let's not kid ourselves. Before unilaterally inviting an invasion, well, I guess I ought to correct that and say even more overwhelming invasion, and unleashing even greater migrant caravans against the southern border of the United States. They've been contradicting themselves a lot lately, though, begins the author. On one hand, they claim they must fight in the courts to uphold the ridiculously anti-health mask mandate. Gotta have the slaves wear their face diapers, you know. On things like airlines and public transportation, just to show who's boss. But on the other hand, they argue that it's time to do away with Title 42 restrictions when it comes to preventing disease-ridden people and invaders in general from crossing the southern border. Yeah, there is a certain inconsistency there. You don't notice that, of course, if you're a far-left nutcase. The Biden regime appears to have violated the law, too, by unilaterally announcing this policy shift without even bothering to wait for that period of public comment. People that can read the Constitution and say, please don't do this, and we're going to do it anyway, as required by the Federal Administrative Procedures Act. Yeah, we don't care about the Bill of Rights anymore, but got to follow those federal procedures. Well, except for when we don't. Earlier this month, it says, the Arizona legislature, along with Missouri, filed the lawsuit against the Biden regime's decision to end Title 42 come the 23rd of May. The decision, which was made by the U.S. Centers for Death and Control, comes at a time when the CDC is otherwise attempting to maintain worse restrictions on the American peons. Isn't that funny? Yeah, they're more than happy to have you invade, but no, you're not allowed to get on a plane if they get their way again without your face diaper. And says the piece, it's widely accepted by Republicans and even far-left socialists that a sharp increase in both illegal and legal immigration will inevitably follow the rescission of the policy. And of course, that's exactly what they want. According to WBOY, administration officials admit that the end of Title 42 will increase illegal monthly border crossings to, well over 500,000, maybe 540,000 or so. And these folks are the ones that they catch and release. States are now seeking a temporary restraining order due to the Biden regime violation of federal procedures, and they've requested that the Department of DHS make an expedited report on the nature of their enforcement of the border and concerning any changes that might have already begun in preparation for the coming invasion. In other words, to encourage it. And so far, he says, the following states have joined the lawsuit. Arizona, Louisiana, Missouri, Alabama, Alaska, Arkansas, Florida, Georgia, Idaho, Kansas, Kentucky, Mississippi, Montana, Nebraska, Ohio, Oklahoma, South Carolina, Tennessee, Utah, West Virginia, and Wyoming. I'm almost tempted to add that any state that isn't on this list ought to be kicked out of the union. But that's kind of what they're already trying to get accomplished, if you think about it. Let's wrap up this segment with a quick look at the tanking economy. The first quarter GDP came out midweek, and it was really ugly. Uglier than expected, even. Recession on deck, says Zero Hedge's midweek headline. Shockingly, the U.S. GDP declined in the first quarter. And today it says, heading into the first estimate of first quarter GDP, estimates were low, certainly far lower than the 6.9%. Oh yeah, you believe in that. Final fourth quarter GDP number, the strongest, allegedly, since the third quarter of 2020. Commenting ahead of the print, Bloomberg said that, quote, a slowdown in the first quarter will prove temporary. Yeah, sure. A consequence of booga, 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 the Omicron variant, and a drag from volatile inventories. Well, says Tyler Durden, what if it's not temporary? And, oh, yeah, just how big of a slowdown? Indeed, just moments before the print, they commented that with three more such GDP numbers to go before the midterm disaster, or at least the midterm disaster covered up with one of the biggest election frauds in history, if you think about it, it wouldn't be a bad idea for the Biden regime to, as they put it, kitchen sink the quarter, lie about it now rather than later when they know they're going to get caught. Kind of break the coming depression to people gradually so that maybe they'll swallow it a bit better. Anyway, they go on to say, the BEA has now reported that in quarter one, the U.S. economy unexpectedly, yeah, sure, shrank by 1.4%, the first acknowledged decline since the COVID summer of 2020. And in the process, shocking what they call the median consensus estimate, which was actually still supposed to be positive, albeit barely. And you do have to give the Biden regime some credit, after all. They've been working awful hard to destroy the economy. And we'll be right back after this.
When I think back on all the crap I learned in high school, it's a wonder I can think at all. And my lack of education hasn't hurt me none. I can read the writing.
Welcome back now to the second segment for this evening. I'm your host, Mark Hall, and let's continue our look back at the week with some of the other big news, some of which the Waste Stream even decided to cover, although the spin was dramatically different. After much hand-wringing among the anti-Bill of Rights left, by Tuesday, what the speech-squelching tyrants feared most finally happened. The story's been percolating since the weekend, but it seemed to have come to fruition Monday afternoon. When Twitter Incorporated announced, according to their full press release, that they'd entered into a definitive agreement to be acquired by an entity wholly owned by Elon Musk for $54.20 per share in cash. The transaction is valued at approximately $44 billion, and upon completion of it, Twitter will become a privately held company. By the way, that purchase price represents a full 38% premium to the closing price of Twitter stock on April Fool's Day this year, the last trading day before Mr. Musk disclosed that he had obtained an approximately 9% stake in the company. I pause at this point because what follows is a whole lot of self-serving BS, in your host's opinion, because after squealing like stuck pigs about the very idea of free speech returning to their platform, Twitter's board finally agreed unanimously, based on shareholder interest, yeah, sure. Oh, yeah, and after they said conducting a thorough and comprehensive process to assess Elon's proposal, they decided it was the best path forward and accepted the proposal. The real reason seems to have been if they hadn't, there would have been a whole lot of angry shareholders with more than sufficient cause to take the entire board to task and to court for a failure to execute their fiduciary duty. And yeah, actually act in the best financial interests of the shareholders, as opposed to what seemed to be obvious anti-free speech left-wing proclivities. Said Elon Musk in a statement after the takeover, quote, free speech is the bedrock of a functioning democracy, whether we were supposed to have one of those or not, folks. And Twitter, he said, is the digital town square where matters vital to the future of humanity are debated. I also, he added, want to make Twitter better than ever by enhancing the product with new features, making the algorithms open source to increase trust, defeating the spam bots, and authenticating all humans. There's an interesting observation. We'll go right back there in just a second. Twitter has tremendous potential, he said. I look forward to working with the company and the community of users to unlock it, unquote. Twitter shares were halted later in the day, pending all the news shaking out. And after Musk announced that they were going to be purging the site of fake humans, i.e. bots, that inflate leftist numbers, there was a whole lot of what the Gateway pundit called freaking out as the bots jumped ship. The meltdown is glorious, they said in their headline. Democrats, thugs, and fascists react with predictable fury to Musk's purchase of Twitter. And part of the reason was because followers on their leftist accounts began decreasing rapidly by the thousands. Evidently because so many of them were never real to begin with. Wonder how many of them knew that's what they'd been doing to conservatives with real people for so long anyway. For example, anti-gun nutcase David Hogg tweeted, is anyone else losing followers too? I'm seeing people across Twitter report they've lost thousands today. And guess who he's talking about? I'm down 5,000. Though much of that, he said, could be because I'm an idiot with way too many followers. IDK. Well, that's not all he don't know about, folks. But for once, at least, he spoke the truth. Mark Hamill, a.k.a. Luke Skywalker from Star Wars, tweeted a couple days ago about how he's just voluntarily taken his booster shot poison poke, hashtag vaxxed and relaxed. But that didn't seem to be the reason that he said, quote, I just lost more than 8,000 followers over the last couple of hours. Was it something I said? No, but obviously you're clueless on more than one front. Concludes Joe Hoft, the left is freaking out as the bots bail on Twitter. Better to get out now before the bot purge occurs. The left, he said, never really did have the followers they thought they did. It was just another far-left lie. Then he asked, what will the real number of followers be when the conservatives are finally allowed back at the table, the bots are gone, and free speech, as the Constitution once actually talked about, is back in force? Well, I hope Joe's optimism isn't misplaced, folks. The truth is we don't know for sure exactly whether Elon Musk is going to follow through on his glorious-sounding promises or not. Although your host has to admit one thing's for sure. Given what Twitter has been, it's impossible to imagine it could be anything but less evil going forward. And so far, at least, this is good news. More than one or two high-profile leftists have jumped ship from Twitter, resigned in a fit of pique, and that too can't help but move things in the right direction. Still, cautions Zero Hedge and Tyler Durden, nothing would surprise us less than if a load of conservative, if they got any left yet, Twitter accounts were suddenly disappeared in air as soon-to-be ex-employees hit the big red cancel button to save us all from the danger that anything approaching free speech represents to their twisted little minds. Oh, and one last thing on that front. Fox News, at least, is reporting that President Trump has said he will not return to Twitter, sale or not. Well, from there, we move on to this, and maybe we'll have a clue fairly soon if Twitter's actually going to improve if we start seeing tweets about things like this that don't at least immediately get deep-sixed. On April 9th, the forced vaccination of once-healthy pilots almost reaped their first major casualty when an American Airlines plane flying into Dallas was only 6 minutes away from crashing when its mandated and vaccinated pilot had a heart attack. His story reads something like this, quote, "My name is Bob Snow. I'm an American Airlines captain and have been a captain for a number of years. My total service with the company is over 31 years, and on November 7, I was mandated to receive the vaccine. Quite literally, I was told if I did not receive the vaccination, I'd be fired. The order was from our director of flight. So, under duress, I received the vaccine. Now, just a few days ago after landing in Dallas, 6 minutes after we landed, I passed out. I coded. I required 3 shocks. I had to be intubated. I'm now in the ICU in Dallas. That is what the vaccine has done for me. I'll probably," he said, "never fly again based upon the criteria the FAA establishes." Now, this is kind of disgustingly sick if you think about it, folks, for pilots. So, yeah, they can mandate you take the poison poke, that's okay, but if it almost kills you, well, now you're done. Anyway, he said, back to the quote, "I was hoping to teach my daughter to fly. She wants to be a pilot. Now, that will probably never happen, all courtesy of the vaccine. Well, and the damnable idiots, folks, who are mandating the Zyklon B injections. All of this," said the pilot, "is unacceptable, and I'm one of the victims. You can see that this is an actual result of the vaccine for some of us. Mandatory, no questions asked, get the shot or you're fired." This, he said, and once upon a time he'd have been correct at least, "this is not the American way." Now, as you might expect, and thankfully, at least a few commentators have picked up on the fact that mandating the not-vaccine Zyklon B injection for pilots is about as damnably stupid as anything could possibly be, not to mention evil, and it does actually violate the FAA's own medical regs, although they certainly managed to ignore that because it's PC too. And as Steve Kirsch writes, "Covering up the injuries and death is in the interest of all of the affected parties, except for the flying public." Well, okay, in the interest of all of those parties that actually have a financial ability to cover it up. So, don't expect a solution anytime soon, or arguably, even an admission. That means flying will be Russian roulette, as he puts it, for a while. Suggesting that if we really cared about passenger safety, every cockpit would be required to have at least one unvaccinated pilot not subject to a sudden heart attack. When the truth gets out, he says, expect a huge pilot shortage and lots of clash action suits by pilots that, in fact, will then lose their licenses to fly. The same thing, he notes, is happening in the military. Hey, did you notice they never explained the cause of that Navy F-35 fighter jet crash? Almost, but not quite, on the deck of the aircraft carrier USS Carl Vinson? If they can just keep it out of the news, they must be thinking, the problem might just go away. Yeah, along with a $100 million airplane. Let's go, Brandon.
Let's go, Brandon. I agree.
Kirsch did an interview, which is up online, with Josh Yoder of U.S. Freedom Flyers about American Airlines Captain Bob Snow and his near-death experience. He says that Captain Snow is home from the hospital, and he's talked to him to confirm the details, including how those that were associated with the case know that it was the so-called vaccine that caused the cardiac arrest. The airline, he said, never even called Snow in the hospital, even though it was their fault he was forced to take the vaccine and almost died along with a plane load of passengers. You'd think, says Kirsch, he'd get a call from the CEO. But maybe, folks, it's already CYA that's the major consideration here. When it comes to things that need to be done, now that so many pilots have been injected with the untested poison, quote, we need to be testing every so-called vaccinated pilot with EKGs, D-dimer, troponin, and cardiac MRIs in order to assess their state of health post-Zyklon B. This is for their health as well as that of the flying public. The airlines and or the FAA should be requiring this. Hey, folks, if the FAA actually enforced their own regulations, these folks would never have been mandated to take the poison poke or even allowed to fly if they chose to afterwards. He notes, too, that myocarditis can be subclinical, so pilots might not know that they're injured, well, until it's too late. The airlines are not doing the screenings to assess pilot health and passenger safety, presumably because if they did so, the public might figure out just how much at risk they are, and it would, of course, disqualify too many pilots. Yoder estimates that perhaps a third of the pilots might need to be disqualified due to heart conditions caused by the poison poke. Therefore, the most likely outcome is the airlines will pretend this incident never happened, and the Centers for Death and Control will claim, with the usual lack of evidence, that there's no link, no link whatsoever, don't worry your pretty little heads about it, to the vaccine. And gee, have we ever heard that before? And the press, true to form, will give them a pass and not ask any hard questions. Now, here's the thing that he doesn't say, but I think bears repeating. Other pilots are certainly pointing it out, too. You notice, folks, how almost always, if there is an airline accident, the crash is ultimately ruled to be pilot error. And at least up until lately, there was always a big grain of truth in this. You could still argue that the pilot was in error by not simply having quit, like so many did, walked off the job and said, take your damned vaccine and shove it somewhere else. Well, what's going to happen now, and there are already indications that this is the way the so-called legal system will do their own CYA, is that, hey, we may have tried to force you to take it, we may have threatened your job, but you didn't have to take it. So ultimately, guess what? It's still pilot error for having caved to the pressure that's being put upon them. From there, this story ought to resonate a bit, at least. The original headline from the Daily Mail quotes The Who for having noted that there's a mysterious outbreak worldwide of liver diseases that look kind of like hepatitis. What could possibly be going on here? That was followed up with a story that may have at least come a bit closer to the truth, saying there have been 169 cases of, quote, acute hepatitis of unknown origin recorded worldwide. Who didn't say which country the deaths have occurred in? There have been 114 cases found in Britain, up to 11 in the United States. Two more British children after the original have now needed a liver transplant. And they're warning parents to be alert for the signs of the liver disease, now spotted in at least a dozen different countries, including the U.S., Ireland, and Spain. Things including jaundice, dark urine, gray-colored feces, itchy skin, muscle pain, fever, lethargy, loss of appetite, and stomach pains. The only thing they seem to know for sure is that UK officials have ruled out the COVID Zyklon B injection, a vaccine, as a possible cause. And have they ever lied before? Because unlike in the U.S., they don't yet try to force kids to take it. In any case, though, it might, they say, have to do with a weakened immunity of the children, leaving them more susceptible to the virus because of the idiotic lockdowns and, of course, the oxygen-depriving and CO2-increasing torturous face diapers. After all, as a separate story from the Royal Society Open Science Journal said this week, 60,000 or so children in the UK did suffer clinical depression as a result of that same idiocy. But when it comes to that mysterious hepatitis, maybe it's a new variant of something or other. They don't say it, but your host will. Have the parents been multiply poked and boosted so that they themselves have become little bioreactors shedding the harmful spike proteins all over the tykes? And I'll throw in this related fact just one more time. Isn't it funny that deaths due to all causes are up literally all over the place across the board? Coincidentally, about the same time frame as the poison poke became widely injected and now increasingly mandated.
Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain.
Oh yeah, they do at least admit the following. Adenovirus was found in 75% of the sick and children who were tested for it. 16% of them had COVID. Well, at least, folks, that means they probably tested positive and may have had a lot of spike proteins in their system. Item, and this one comes from the oh-so-free Ukraine, along with their martial law, not to mention Zero Hedge and Bitcoin Magazine. Ukraine's central bank, they say, is prohibiting the Ukrainian people from buying bitcoins with the hryvnia in an attempt, they claim, to prevent what they call unproductive capital outflows. But the new restrictions aren't just exclusive to Bitcoin. The directives imposed by the NBU, National Bank of Ukraine, cover a slew of asset purchases of what they call quasi-cash transactions. Everything from other crypto coins to the payment of traveler's checks. And, said those central banksters, that's about preserving the health of the country's foreign exchange market. Oh, yeah, and in addition to cryptocurrency, the new rules also target electronic wallet deposits, foreign exchange transactions, and other travel payments. And in other aspects of the push to World War III, we've got several stories. One from Zero Hedge says, in what's called a major reversal following Chancellor Olaf Scholz only days ago voicing strong resistance, now it seems Berlin has bowed to the mounting pressure from other NATO allies and approved new tank deliveries to Ukraine from Germany's own stock, which Scholz previously claimed were depleted. Now the German Ministry of Defense announced that delivery of Gepard anti-aircraft tanks to Ukraine has been approved, and Russia, it seems, isn't happy about that, even though they're old and pretty well worthless. Although high-ranking American traders, like the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Marxist Milley, and so-called Defense Secretary, how's that for disgusting laugh, Lloyd Austin, are really thrilled about it. I guess they love having proxies poke the bear for them. Top Russian foreign diplomat and Kremlin foreign minister Sergei Lavrov, as another headline from the Daily Mail reports, isn't taking this lying down. Speaking on Russian state TV Monday night, he accused Western leaders of risking a third world war by supplying those heavy weapons to Ukraine with the goal of, quote, wearing down the Russian army, and that, he described, was an illusion. And he added, accusing NATO and its allies of attempting to bully Russia on the international stage, he said tensions between the East and the West are now worse than they were during the Cuban Missile Crisis at the height of the Cold War. And asked directly about the possibility of nukes being exchanged, he replied, quote, the risks are very significant. I do not want the danger to be artificially inflated, but it is serious, real, and he said it cannot be underestimated. And of all the things he said, folks, this may have been the most disturbing. Quote, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, said Lavrov, there were not many written rules, but the codes of conduct were clear enough. Moscow understood how Washington was behaving. Washington understood how Moscow was behaving. Now, he said, there are few rules left. And in those years, he added, there was a channel of communication that both leaders trusted. Now there's no such channel, and nobody is trying to create it. And let's be honest here, folks. What good is talking to a senile puppet anyway? And he also warned that shipments of Western weapons into Ukraine would be considered by Russia to be legitimate targets. And finally, on that same subject, there's this. Russia announced on Monday they're expelling 40 German diplomats in a stunning tit-for-tat move, given the huge size of the group of officials being booted from Russian soil. The Kremlin said it's a response to the unfriendly decision of Berlin, no, not just with the tanks in the last couple of days, but earlier this month to expel Russian diplomats there due to the invasion of Ukraine. The foreign ministry called it a symmetrical response. And obviously, with all of that on the table today, we don't want to forget the traitors and morons and senile cretins and imposters, all of which claim to be running this disgusting show. Here's another headline from the Daily Mail, late Tuesday morning. Exclusive, it says, Joe's missing millions. Listen carefully to this. Financial records that have been, what, lied about, covered up by the FBI for a long time? They were hidden on the infamous laptop from hell. From the crackhead whoremonger son Hunter. Anyway, it says, they reveal Biden had $5.2 million in unexplained income. As emails show, he paid Hunter's legal bills for one megabucks Chinese deal and was tapped as, oh, say it with me, folks, you've heard this before, the big guy to get a 10% cut in another. Now, well, it may be an exclusive to the Daily Mail, but the rest of us have known about most of this for a long, long time now, in spite of the attempts by the waste stream and the instigators at the Federal Bureau of such to cover it up. Says the story, the revelations here tie the president, sick, even closer to Hunter's overseas business dealings than the White House has been lying about, obviously, and they make his previous claims that he never discussed them with his son even less plausible than they already were. Here's the money quote. The missing millions, says the Daily Mail, combined with emails on Hunter's abandoned laptop, suggesting Joe would have a 10% share in Hunter's blockbuster deals with the Chinese, raise a troubling question. Did Joe Biden receive money from the foreign venture? What do you say to that? Is he a liar? Is he a crook? Is he senile? Well, none of these are questions that the rest of the American waste stream media even wants you to worry your pretty little heads about. Here's another story, same source, equally, revealing, albeit late. The incompetent hanger-on to the faux president, Kamala Heels-in-the-Air Harris, has now tested positive for COVID. The double-vaccinated and double-boosted VP is now being forced to isolate after a trip to California, but is not considered a close contact of the senile masked idiot. Said her press secretary, Kirsten Allen, she's not been a recent contact to either the president, sick, or first lady, sick, due to recent travel schedules. And since Oregon socialist Ron Johnson and Connecticut communist Chris Murphy also have the booga-booga flu, in spite of being fully you-know-whatted, the Senate spent the whole week just a few comrades shy of a full commune. Next, courtesy of Zero Hedge and the economic meltdown still in progress, some interesting comments from Dr. Doom, a.k.a. Noriel Rubini, via the Project Syndicate as well, who writes that while recent shocks have made the current inflationary surge and growth slowdown more acute, they're hardly the global economy's only problems. Hey, isn't that wonderful? Even without them, however, the medium-term outlook would be darkening, owing to a broad range of economic, political, environmental, and demographic trends. This new reality, he writes, with which many advanced economies and emerging markets must reckon, is higher inflation and slowing economic growth. Who could have thought it? And a big reason for the current bout of stagflation is a series of negative aggregate supply shocks that have curtailed production and increased costs. All of this should come as no surprise, he says, and it doesn't. The COVID-19 pandemic, and he didn't spell it right, forced many sectors to lock down. It disrupted global supply chains and produced an apparently persistent reduction in the labor supply, especially in the now utterly openly socialist United States. Then came Russia's having taken the bait, the invasion of Ukraine, which, along with the idiotic responses to it, your host notes, have driven up the prices of energy, industrial metals, food, and fertilizers. And now communist China, too, has ordered their own draconian COVID-1984 lockdowns in major economic hubs such as Shanghai, causing additional supply chain disruptions and transport bottlenecks. But, he says, even without these important short-term factors, the medium-term outlook would still be darkening. And he outlines a number of reasons, like the recent retreat from globalization and a return to various forms of protectionism, reflecting not only geopolitical factors and domestic political motivations, especially where large cohorts of the population feel left behind by the far left, your host notes. Rising geopolitical tensions and supply chain drama left by the pandemic are also likely to lead to more what he calls reshoring of manufacturing from communist China and emerging markets to advanced economies, or at least nearshoring or friendshoring, where they try to get stuff from suppliers they can actually trust. As he puts it, politically allied countries. But either way, production will be misallocated to higher cost regions and countries. I'm not sure if I'd use the word misallocated, because it's better to have them than wish you had them and not. But he's right to the extent that either way, it will increase costs to the consumer. And he goes on to talk about demographics, you know, the aging population, which will further reduce the supply of labor and increase further pressure on wage inflation. There's also, he says, a sustained political and economic backlash against immigration. I would use the term invasion and say, yeah, you're darn right, and it's justified. The days in which large-scale immigration kept the lid on wage growth appear to be over. And similarly, he says, the new Cold War, not between the U.S. and Russia, that one may get hot, but the U.S. and China will produce wide-ranging stagflationary effects as well. We have the fragmentation of the global economy, balkanization of supply chains, and tighter restrictions on trade and things like technology, data, and information, all key elements of future trade patterns. Oh yeah, and let's not forget, whether it's bogus or not, the impacts of supposedly man-made climate change, or at least the idiotic responses to it, all of which will be stagflationary. Anyway you slice it, he says, droughts damage crops, ruin harvest, drive up food prices, just like hurricanes, floods, and other supposed climate change effects do too. Yeah, let's not forget public health, he notes, and your host adds, and the damage to the prestige of the so-called medical system caused by their own perfidy. And yeah, there's cyber warfare too, as recent severe disruptions in production and attacks on pipelines, meat processors, and food processors have all demonstrated. There are also costs, that will get passed on to consumers. All of these factors, he said, will add fuel to the political backlash against the stark income and wealth inequalities by the leftist lurch, leading to more fiscal spending to support workers, the unemployed, vulnerable minorities, and the left behind. In other words, another triumph for the Hegelian dialectic. Why, he says, even AI, automation, and robotics are not an unalloyed good, because they'll bring their own disruptions. Last and hardly least, there's the weaponization of the U.S. dollar and the backlash against the world fiat reserve currency. Also stagflationary. Let's call it yet one more word to the wise.